A jail stint can really disrupt someone's life. You can lose a job, a relationship, or thousands of dollars on fees, fines, and bail.
Have I ever gone to jail? Yeah, I just got out, actually.
If he doesn't show up to court, you gotta pay the $50,000.
No ring exchange, no kiss the bride. There's no glamour in a jailhouse wedding.
Off the Block. All six episodes tracing the path from city block to jail block and back are now available on KCRW's iTunes page.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
This is challenging material, and it's a world that most places you show it, it's going to feel like a world away from anybody else's life. And yet I've been consistently amazed at how much people are seeing of themselves in the film, and I think that's the key.
When Barry Jenkins' film Moonlight premiered at Telluride this year, he had no idea how many people would connect with his drama about a gay black boy growing up in a tough Miami neighborhood. Jenkins and producer Adela Romansky tell us how persistence and kismet led to the creation of awards contender Moonlight. But first on the News Banter, Hollywood is in a Trump tailspin. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my banter buddy, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, Matt, I think for the past few days and for many days to come, Hollywood at large, and the majority, the great majority of people who work in Hollywood are still, they're just not going to be able to digest a Donald Trump victory in the presidential election, possibly ever. But certainly it has, I would guess, slowed down the work that gets done. Every conversation I've had with any executive or producer has included several minutes on the election. And I'm going to guess that's true in every office building that produces anything in this community.
Right. I mean, I think the sense is that people are depressed. We published a story the other day calling it a Trump daze. And, you know, there were emails sent around some of the talent agencies basically saying, you know, we know people are upset and feel even threatened and high anxiety about this, you know, and trying to kind of help people move forward. I know a lot of celebrities have gone public with their criticism. Some, you know, Harvey Weinstein sent us an email saying he's hoping for the best and that Trump will be inclusive and allow a sense of collaboration with all sides. I don't know if that's realistic.
Yeah, he cited the team of rivals, which was Lincoln. And I don't think a lot of people see Lincoln in Donald Trump.
No, certainly not. You know, but I think that now the question is moving forward, what people do. I mean, is there going to be a sense of mobilization to try to change things in 2 years and 4 years? Is there, you know, Jeffrey Katzenberg has been silent so far. He's the big ringleader for political activity in the industry. The question is, how are people going to react and move forward?
Yeah, I've seen certain people like Lin-Manuel Miranda, you know, immediately tweeting on the night of the election, you know, we have to fight and we have to organize and fight. I don't know, you know, with the Republican House, Senate, White House, and soon to be packed Supreme Court, it's going to be tough to find weapons in the fight. But I think there will be a sense that something has to be done. I should say that not everyone in Hollywood is upset. There is a conservative group. It is called Friends of Abe. It was founded by Gary Sinise, and the early members included Kelsey Grammer and John Voight. They had an event the night of the election. They were happy.
Yeah, absolutely. There are conservatives that actually have been associated with the Trump campaign that come from the Hollywood world. The biggest one, I think, is Steve Mnuchin, who has been floated as a possible Treasury Secretary for Trump. He is a big Hollywood dealmaker. His company, Dune, raised a lot of capital that was put into Fox movies. He was briefly the chairman of Relativity before it went into all of its problems. And, you know, he has a lot of Hollywood experience on the deal side. He also worked at Goldman Sachs. So that could be a direct connection to the industry. The other one is Tom Barrack, who has been a Trump supporter. He is the chairman of Colony Capital, which was the owner of Miramax for a while before it sold that company. So there are some connections to the industry. Just the vast majority of the rank and file and all of these studio heads were all for Hillary.
Yeah, I would say that as this is analyzed, there is going to be attention lavished on cable news and its role. Already in the last couple of days, a shareholder asked at a Fox shareholder meeting, brought up the question, asked Rupert Murdoch, you know, whether there would be some examination of the role of Fox News in bringing us to this place. Obviously, the implication being that Fox News has done a very conservative message to its audience and, of course, gave Donald Trump a platform to promote his birther myth. And I don't think this is the sort of thing that truly can take hold at a company like Fox. I don't think they're going to suddenly say, oh, yes, we didn't do a good job. But CNN is also going to come in for a lot of post-election paddling, already has, for providing a very uncritical platform for Trump for a long time because of ratings. You know, Trump was a ratings draw.
Absolutely. Those ratings were gigantic. I mean, CNN had its most watched election night ever. And this whole bonanza is probably going to continue with Trump because there is such fear and interest in him that it's going to drive ratings, in my opinion. But to me, the most interesting thing to watch in the cable news world will be what happens to MSNBC. Because I actually think that MSNBC, which has sort of been the also-ran in the cable news wars, really has an opportunity here to reestablish itself based on being a voice of opposition. You know, it's got very liberal-leaning anchors and commentators, and it hasn't really had the traction over the Obama years that Fox News has. And I think with a Trump presidency, you're going to see people on the liberal side perhaps gravitating towards MSNBC as a place to kind of galvanize and hear that opposition argument.
Yeah, and kind of process what, you know, and help them catalyze what is going on in this country.
It's an opportunity for them. And obviously, how Fox News covers Trump and whether those alt-right voices start to appear on Fox News, that's a big question as well.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. The new movie Moonlight tells the story of Chiron, who grows up black, poor, and gay in Miami. When classmates chase him into an abandoned building, he falls under the protection of Juan, played by Mahershala Ali. Juan is a drug dealer who takes an interest in Chiron. Early in the film, Juan returns the frightened child to his home and encounters Chiron's mother, played by Naomi Harris.
What happened, Chiron? Why you didn't come home like you're supposed to? Huh? And who is you?
Nobody. I found him yesterday. Found him in a hole on 15. Yeah, that one. Some boys chased him in the cut. He scared more than anything. He wouldn't tell me where he lived till this morning.
Well, thanks for seeing to him. He usually can take care of himself. Be good that way.
Later, we see Chiron as a high schooler and then as a young man, trying to make his way in a world that is unwilling to accept him. Three different actors portray Chiron at the various stages of his life. This is the second film for writer-director Barry Jenkins. He made his first, Medicine for Melancholy, on a $15,000 budget with a loan from a friend. 8 years passed before Jenkins was back with Moonlight. Producer Adela Romansky and Jenkins went to film school together at Florida State. When we sat down with them, Jenkins told us that growing up in the same poverty-stricken Miami neighborhood as his main character, he had no thought of becoming a filmmaker.
Yeah, I didn't have dreams or aspirations and things like that. When I went to Florida State, I thought I'd be an English teacher because, you know, the few people who I thought were really positive in my life growing up were teachers, usually English teachers, so I thought I'll emulate that. But other than that, I never really had any thoughts of what the future was like. I kind of just took everything a day at a time. And I even only applied to college because there was a guidance counselor in high school who like brought me into her office and said, you have to apply to colleges now.
Were you a good student?
I was.
So people saw talent and aptitude and something.
Aptitude, yeah. I guess that's what it was. Yeah.
So you were like, oh, I have to apply to college?
Yeah, you know, no, I was like, oh, yeah, of course, I should apply to college. And so I just applied to all the state schools in Florida, basically USF, University of Florida, and Florida State University.
This is going to be a proud testimonial to public education, I guess, right?
Literally. I think the film school at Florida State was started to drive the film industry in the state. And so they felt like if they could train kids from the state of Florida to make movies, that they would help bring more industry to the state. And so it was a great film school. It was really inexpensive. They paid for all the equipment, all the stock. You know, it was like there was no other way because of my background, just being poor, that I could have afforded to go to film school. So, yeah, it's a great advertisement. I feel like I am, you know, for state-funded initiatives. Yeah.
I mean, am I remembering right that you were raised by a single mom, like the character in the film?
Yes and no. My mom was kind of not really in the house. I was raised by like kind of like family friends and things like that. And the second story of Moonlight, this character, Janelle Monáe's character Teresa, is sort of like there's a close analog to that in my life, but not necessarily living with my mom.
When you get to school, like where does the film light bulb go off for you?
Well, there were two stages. One, when I went to Florida State, I didn't realize there was a film school there at the time, but I'm a big football fan, and the film school is in the football stadium. And so just in being around the stadium, I realized, oh, there's a film school here. There's all these signs everywhere. So I applied and I got in. And at first, it was really tough because, you know, we shot everything on film back then. And, you know, it's a lot more difficult than turning on a digital camera and seeing exactly what's there. You have to kind of know what the light is doing and what the stock is doing and things like that. So I took a year off and to train myself, you know, on photography. And then I went back into...
You were sort of training yourself, like you didn't have to go to film 101 school?
No. I mean, the film school was film 101, but I thought, oh, I'll learn how to, you know, take 35 millimeter still images. I'll watch really good films. I'll read really good film criticism. I'll just get up to speed with my classmates. And the beauty of it is, so Adela's husband is also the cinematographer on Moonlight. And he came into the program a year later and he shot this film, Moonlight, my first film, Medicine, all my film school films. But we wouldn't have been in the same class had I continued on the track I was in when I first got into film school. All these things have a way of working themselves out.
So where were you? You were at the school. Obviously, that's where you met. But were you more like, I'm going to do film? Or were you going to be an English teacher too?
No, I wasn't going to be an English teacher, but I also did not go there thinking I was going to study film. This is really embarrassing, but I went there to be, I think I was going to be an actor.
That's right. I forgot that.
Because I'm so deeply uncomfortable at the idea now of being in front of the camera. But yeah, I went there and I was doing theater and I was doing history and I was studying French. And then the first year in Tallahassee, I ended up meeting David Mitchell, who was in the film program already, another director that I'm working with now and that we went to Florida State together. And I remember meeting him and then through him meeting other film school kids and thinking, wow, these guys are really interesting. They're a lot more interesting and a lot more cool than the theater students. I think I'll switch majors.
Ah, and you met Barry at that.
And I met Barry. And I think that in making the switch from theater to film, I realized, you know, I think that when you grow up in a small town, I grew up in a small town on the west, on the Gulf Coast of Florida, and you know, I was interested in movies and I was interested in art, but there isn't this obvious path to making movies when you're growing up in a small community like that. And so I think you gravitate towards like the community theater and the drama programs. And you think because actors are so front and center in entertainment, you think that's kind of the one obvious choice about how you can be involved in making movies. And so then when I discovered the film school at Tallahassee, it was the first time that I was seeing, oh, there's all these other craftspeople and all these other roles that I could possibly play in the creation of these stories. And so I think I found where I was best suited.
Yeah, that's the idea of college, right?
Yeah. It is how it's supposed to work.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So you decide to make a film.
Mm-hmm.
And you make a film. The film is well received. And then there's this long intermission, 8 years.
Mm-hmm.
I have to protest that idea of this long 8-year intermission.
Okay. 5-year intermission.
But was it even? Because when you do the math, like, okay, Medicine was 2008, but then you spent a year touring with it. It came out in 2009. So that accounts for one of those years, right? Mm-hmm. And then you were writing for Focus because you had that deal.
Mm-hmm.
And then you started a company where you were doing commercials and branded content.
Mm-hmm.
And then I called you up in 2013 to say, let's do something, and something became this movie.
Mm-hmm.
So 2013 to now, that's 3 years. So we knock another.
But it's so much cooler when you just go
8 years.
It's not
like you were just sitting in the corner,
but
Barry.
But it's so much cooler that way.
We try not to fictionalize our actual interviews. You could do that on the.
I think it takes away credit that you are.
I mean, I think it sounds a little reductive. Yeah, like, oh yeah, 8 years. But you like it.
No, well, I mean, it has been 8 years between films.
Right.
That much is true.
Both things are true.
Yeah, but exactly. But yeah, I was doing things the whole while. Most of those things were very short, like short films, branded content, commercials, things like that. And the other features just didn't work, you know. But this film, I think, relatively speaking, came together pretty quickly, you know.
Well, so this play, this is a Terrell Alvin McCraney mm-hmm. wrote this play, which was called In Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue. And had you seen it before?
No, so it was never performed, and he wrote it.
Oh, it was never performed, yes.
Yeah, he wrote it in 2003. He was graduating from DePaul undergrad as an actor and applying to Yale School of Drama as a playwright, and he had to do a work sample. And so this was one of three work samples that he wrote. And I think it was never performed because it wasn't a play. It just wasn't. You know, I think it was a playwright writing something. They didn't have a place on the stage. And so when it came to me, literally 10 years later, it had been through a few different permutations, but again, he had never really done anything with it. And when I read it, I just saw, oh, this is definitely a movie. And so Terrell and I started working to figure out what the version of it that was the best movie.
And it came to you how?
Through a group of kids. I call them kids because they're younger than me, but a group of artists in Miami called Borscht, like the Russian soup. Basically, when Art Basel started coming to Miami, this great art scene kind of just sprung up out of nowhere, you know, partly out of some very savvy developers, but also out of a genuine passion for art. And so these Miami kids were like, well, instead of having all these people moving to LA and New York, you know, let's try to keep Miami artists here and let's try and bring people back to tell stories about the city. And so Terrell's from Miami. I'm from Miami. I'd made a movie about San Francisco, which is as far removed from Miami as you can get. Their whole point was, why would this guy not come back to Miami and make a movie? And so when they read Terrell's piece, they thought of me and they put the two of us together.
Gosh, there really does feel like there's a power shaping this whole event.
Some larger puppet master.
Exactly. I think for one, I'd done a short film with Borscht in like 2011, 2012. And that to me was a toe dip on their part to again get me to come back and make something. And, you know, this in the movie, Naomi Harris plays this character, Paula, who's the main character's mom, sort of a composite of my mom and Terrell's mom. And not a lot of people know that about me, that I went through some of these things with my mother, except these kids at Borscht. And so they were just perfectly situated to know that there was something in Terrell's piece that I would connect to.
I mean, this is such an affirming story. The university thing works out. The art thing works out. So, Adela, are you then, I'm trying to figure out how you circle back in here. I know you at some point came to Barry and said, hey, dude, make a movie. Is that exactly what you said?
I don't remember exactly what I said. I've heard Barry paraphrase it a few different ways. Sometimes it involves cursing.
It always involves cursing, if I'm saying it.
When he tells it, it always involves cursing. No, I had an experience just before I called him where it was a pretty negative experience on another project. And I came out the other side of that just really questioning, like, why am I doing what I'm doing? What should I be doing? Like, what do I want? Sort of this sort of moment of like deep personal introspection. And then I concluded with like, okay, I want to make really good movies with really good people who I know and love and trust. Who's at the top of that list? Barry Jenkins. So then I called Barry and said,
What's the word? Is it a multi-syllable word that begins with mother or something like that?
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if I really said that, but I did really call you and say, you need to make something and I'm going to help you make it.
And what were you thinking at that moment?
I mean, she's feisty. So I was like, and she didn't say it. She said it nicely, but yeah, persistently. And I want to say passively, but really aggressively. but then we built like an infrastructure to sort of make it happen. You know, Moonlight wasn't the first thing on the list. She told me make a list of things you would want to do. And so we started out with like, well, I don't know, 25, 30 ideas. And over the process of about 6 months, we would just, cause we were in different cities, we would get together on these like G chats or Skype sessions and just talk through, you know, these different ideas. And over the course of about 4 or 5 months, we whittled it down to two, one of which was this.
Coming up after a short break, director Barry Jenkins and producer Adela Romansky tell us why part of Moonlight was written in Brussels. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Listen to KCRW's music stream, Eclectic 24, for hand-picked music around the clock. You can find all of KCRW's produced content on our app. Download for free at kcrw.com/apps.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to writer-director Barry Jenkins and producer Adela Romansky about their new film, Moonlight, which tells the story of a gay African-American youth named Chiron at three different points in his life as he grows up in poverty in Miami. Different actors play Chiron in each of the film's three chapters. Trevante Rhodes plays Chiron when the character is in his early 20s and has moved away from his hometown. He returns to visit his oldest friend, Kevin, played in this chapter by Andre Holland. The two had been close in the past, though they never discussed their relationship.
What you looking at me like that for?
What, man? Come on, you just drove down here? Yeah. Like you was just on one, and you hit the highway. Yeah.
After Jenkins and Romansky agreed to work on Moonlight, a chance meeting at the Telluride Film Festival gave the project a boost.
Now, you had encountered Plan B, which is Brad Pitt's production company, Jeremy Kleiner and Dee Dee Gardner. There are a couple of producers with some success.
Mm-hmm. Just a little bit.
12 Years a Slave and...
Selma, True Life.
Big Short.
Yeah, just a few little films that have been in the awards conversation. Mm-hmm. I guess you encountered them at Telluride because you worked at Telluride.
Yeah, well, you know, it actually goes back to the first film, the $15,000 movie. You know, those guys they just scour the earth. You know, if something's interesting and new, they want to know about it. So I met with them from the first film, Medicine for Melancholy. And like most things in those 5 years, you know, not a lot came of it, you know. And I guess I hadn't seen him in about 2 or 3 years. And that's the beauty of this whole process. Adela and I would never have targeted Plan B, you know, to come and work with us on Moonlight. But yeah, I've worked at the Telluride Film Festival since 2002. And I introduce films there. I do Q&As.
You're one of those guys.
I'm just one of those guys. And that festival doesn't release the schedule until the day of. And so I had no idea 12 Years was going to be there. I'm sure they had no idea that I worked there. And only 8 hours before the premiere, I was told that I was going to be the master of ceremonies at the world premiere of 12 Years a Slave. But I actually had just gotten back from Europe on this trip where Adela had sent me or pushed me or jettisoned me to do this writing. And so it was this wonderful moment where very organically, it's like, hey, I haven't seen you in a while. This is after the premiere goes well.
Yes. I'm sure they were in a good mood.
Exactly. They were in a very good mood. I was like, I haven't seen you in a while. I was like, oh, I actually just came back from Europe working on this thing by Terrell McCraney. And they're Plan B being Plan B, we know exactly who Terrell McCraney is. That sounds interesting. When it's at a good place, you know, send it to us. And, you know, here we are 3 years later. You know.
Puppet Master.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, Puppet Master, I'm going to turn to you and pause. Mm-hmm. Why did you make Barry go to Europe to write?
Barry needed to get someplace where there were no distractions. I didn't specifically choose Europe.
I chose
Brussels.
Europe. Yeah. Yeah.
Brussels, of all places.
Yeah, it was very hot. I didn't speak the language. I didn't know anyone. And I will say, in a poll, in an informal poll of friends, I asked, what's the most boring place to go in Europe in the summer? And everybody came back and said Brussels. And so I had a lovely time in Brussels, and it was very fruitful. But that's what the polling told me, was that Brussels was the place to go.
Yeah, good chocolate.
Extremely. And I taught them how to make a Manhattan at this bar called Lord Byron. Ah, amazing bar. It's where I wrote at least 40% of this. And then I had to rewrite at least 80% of that 40%.
And then A24 comes in. They're going to make it their first production thing, which is they've done very well distributing. But so, boy, does it feel like a lot, right place, right time. Now, this is a film, you know, I was actually surprised because I'm sure like 1,000 other people, I just assumed you were a gay black man, but you're not. You're a black man, but you're not gay. Mm-hmm. Did you worry at all that people would say, what do you know about that experience?
No, I did. And that's why at the beginning of the writing process, you know, my hope was that Terrell, he had already, you know, written in Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue, which was very rich and there were things in it. And yet, you know, I felt like the filmed version needed this extension and, you know, this reconfiguration, all these things. And my solution, I thought, for that was to keep him at the center of it as the writer. But what I realized over the process of, again, this 4 or 5 months exchanging notes was that I should, as the director, you know, and as a writer-director, I should take authorship of it. And yet what I arrived at was, if I could preserve his voice, the question that you're sort of broaching that I was anticipating, I had to push past that and just get to the point where I became the author of the piece. And I felt like preserving his voice was the way to do that, and just pairing it with really genuine, like, empathy for the subject matter.
Mm. Now, in another way, you were very close to the subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
I read that you've only been able to sort of sit through the movie one time.
Once. Well, I mean, I'm with the public audience, just once, yeah.
It's just emotional for you.
It is. I mean, and making it was emotional too. It's like, how much emotionality do I need to experience with this film? You know, the film is the film, and the audience's experience of it is one thing. Sharing that experience with them, it just feels like this whole other thing that I don't need very often, you know?
You're dealing with a very specialized group of filmmakers with Plan B and A24. Studios don't do that many movies like this, and Plan B is not a studio.
Mm-hmm.
But the marketability of a film about a young, gay, black kid, you know, a lot of people would be like, can't sell that.
Yeah, I mean, I work with the mindset of, it's unmarketable, so let's not even think about it. Let's just get it right. Let's get the voice right. Let's get the world right. Let's get the characters right. You know, make it look the way you want it to look. It was all about, let's just max out everything, and we will create the market for the film, just in the film being distinct and unique. And we never had any, like, formal talks about it.
I think we pushed that aside right out. You know, it was like, yes, that's there, and we're not going to acknowledge it, and we're not going to think about it.
Yeah.
Because I think, I mean, I believe that if the work is strong enough, that it really doesn't matter what about the work might be perceived as unmarketable or inaccessible.
Yeah, but it's weird though, because there are really amazing films that never find a market. I mean, and we've only been out for 3 weeks now, you know, and who's to say if we've actually found, you know, a marketability so far, so good. But I just feel like, again, going back to just the stars aligning, you know, there was just something with this film. You know, I'll say this, the way things worked was, it was myself and Adela for a time, then myself, Adela, and Plan B, then myself, Adela, Plan B, and A24. That was sort of like the calendar of how things linked up. And once A24 came in, I kind of like had a sigh of relief, because I thought, okay, if I bring back something that's unique, they're going to find a way to find whatever market can possibly exist for this film. And so in some ways, I think because of the partnership with an amazing distributor, you know, it kind of helped solve that riddle, or the riddle that none of us wanted to acknowledge, which is, how the hell do we make the story marketable, you know?
Well, so you could not have anticipated the reaction. I mean, I think the New York Times, like, literally just had a breakdown over this movie.
No, I could not have anticipated it at all. And even, you know, we world premiered at Telluride, and even still, I wasn't prepared for just how warm the reception would be, you know? This is challenging material, and it's a world that no matter where you show it, you know, or most places you show it, it's going to feel like a world away from anybody else's life. And yet I've been consistently just amazed at how much people are seeing of themselves in the film. And I think that's the key, you know, as talking about the marketing, you know, that's just the key. People are finding a way to see themselves in the film. And, you know, it's election day. We're having this conversation right now.
Who knew?
I know, when so many things are being decided about the state of the union. And I think one of the wonderful things about this film, just having been so many different places with it, is people from all over, they can find this common ground and this common thread in our characters and our story. And if you don't know how to market that, then that's a problem, you know?
Have your people in Miami seen the movie?
Most. Everyone but my mom. My mom's the only one who hasn't watched it. She'll watch it when she's ready, but everybody else has seen it, yeah.
I guess it could be kind of a hard thing for her potentially to watch if it's that similar to...
Yeah, an extremely hard thing. But I love... my sister saw the film. My sister's a very tough critic. And she called me right away and said, oh, Naomi Harris, kill that. And Naomi's basically playing our mom. So,
right.
So I was like, okay, that's a ringing endorsement.
Barry Jenkins is the director, and Adela Romansky is the producer of Moonlight. Thank you guys for coming in.
Thanks for having us.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.